That back on.
All right, research designs. A long time ago, but not as long as you might think, we decided to commit ourselves to making comparisons, that our research would make comparisons. Within psychology, and specifically clinical psychology by itself, there was a time when the purpose of clinical psychology training, therapeutic psychology of all its different ilks, was to make sure that you understood what the diagnostic categories were and what the normal course was for people in those diagnostic categories. So that if you then came up with a treatment or a protocol, that you would know whether that treatment had an effect or not, because you knew what was regular or the control. And eventually, I'll go we here, eventually we figured out that there isn't just one normal, and that even when there was fairly consistent patterns of behavior of, say, schizophrenia over time, that not everybody had the same comparison in their heads. And at that point, we said, all right, enough with the demo. We have to start making comparisons. And the demonstration of that, the demonstration of a comparison instead of a demonstration of a group, and you know what it would look like otherwise. John Stuart Mill, one of my absolute heroes, was the person who gave us control groups. He was a British philosopher of science, and he literally is the one who said, "The hell. Shouldn't we have a comparison group that we control as much as we control the treatment group?" And that's where all of this came from. And so everything we're going to do, ask the question, what's the cleanest comparison we can set up? Remembering that we care about confounds and we care about quality, whether it's an associative hypothesis test or a causal hypothesis test. Because, sing it with me, confounds change results, whether they're associative or causal results. One of the things we really want to do when we're trying to evaluate a study and when we're trying to design a study is make sure that we take apart internal validity, that we take a look at initial equivalence and ongoing equivalence and evaluate both. Remember that initial equivalence is about properties of the participants. Ongoing equivalence is properties of the procedure. So in this weird study, we're comparing pieces of clothing that have been washed in Tide versus Brand X. So the clothing is the participants. All right? So any properties of the clothing are issues of initial equivalence. Any properties of the washing process are ongoing equivalence. So, getting completely out of the realm of anything that you're likely to study in your research future, really dirty, light-colored clothes washed in a small amount of cold water for 5 minutes with a single rinse using Brand X. Versus barely dirty, dark-colored clothes washed in a large amount of hot water for 25 minutes with a double rinse using Tide. Now, we're supposed to be comparing Tide and Brand X. The question is whether that comparison is clean. No pun intended. So, what are initial equivalence confounds between these two comparison groups? Color of the clothes. And? How dirty? If you were going to grab two sets of clothes, one of which was dirty, light colored, the other which is barely dirty, dark colored, which one would you pick to then put into the product you are making and betting the family fortune on? With me? Okay, so this is what's known as stacked confounding. Ongoing equivalence is properties of the procedure. Are there any elements of the procedure that are not a fair comparison between the conditions? There's a lot of this. Well, hell yeah, Cal. Did you read this? Yeah, I read it. Amount of temperature of water, amount of washing, and the rinse process. All of which are procedural variable confounds. all of which are boogering up ongoing equivalents. And again, notice they're stacked. Every confound is pushing in the same direction. Better scores for Tide.
The only way that could be worse is if everyone was like a crappy washing machine.
That's right. Oh, I forgot to tell you, this one stopped 5 minutes into the cycle. Yes. And by the way, that's a great exercise. You look at this and you say, well, this is just the crap they told us about. What aren't they articulating about the procedure or the clothing that I'd like to know, because see if there's more. Great point. This is so much fun. Later in the course, we're going to talk about a larger panoply and taxonomy and organization of research designs. Right now, we're going to keep it to just two. True experiments and non-experiments. Here's some other language over there. We'll come back to that. Now, we have to separate two things. We have to separate the kind of design we have and whether we have causal interpretability. Because design is defined by process. Causal interpretability is designed by defined by result. Here's what I mean. We will define a true experiment as having two properties. Random assignment of individuals by the researcher before manipulation of the independent variable. And two, control of the manipulation of the independent variable by the researcher. If it has those two things, it's a true experiment. Being a true experiment does not guarantee causal interpretability. Because there's still one element of the evidence for a causal research hypothesis that's left out, which is ongoing equivalence, no difference by procedural variables. So we define an experiment by its process. We define causal interpretability at the end of the study when we ask, do we have any confounds? So causal interpretability, to bring it down to one statement, causal interpretability requires a true experiment with no confounds. Okay? Many things become a form of humor in this course. You with me? A true experiment defined by random assignment and researcher-controlled manipulation with no confounds. Which means the randomization took, the manipulation didn't cause any confounds, and nothing in the task completion data collection caused any confounds. You with me? Remember, this goes all the way back to stuff that you've heard. Science is defined as science by its methodology. True experiment is defined by the processes we used. Causal interpretability is defined by the result of those processes. Yes?
So it does kind of feel laughable.
It's hard. Yes, I'm with you.
So is the only way to really have causal interpretability if we do the replication and the convergence?
What we do is assemble evidence. Probabilistic, empirical, quantitative evidence. The deeper and more consistent the stack, the more comfortable we are when we use the C word. Okay? Now, if that's a stack of things on some variable that is eminently poofable, on large samples that are easily controlled, a shorter stack's going to make us more happy. I have a friend who likes the pancake example. There's some places where you only get a pancake this big. There's only this much goodness in that pancake. So to get enough goodness, you need a bigger stack of pancakes. But there's other places, other research studies, that have bigger pancakes. There's more goodness in that study because of the way that they can control it more. And you can get away with a shorter stack before you're as full. I love awful metaphors and examples like that. But you're absolutely right. We don't use the word laughable among our peers. That's okay. It's just sort of impolite to say, yeah, that's going to work. What we do is we work towards it with careful attention to community standards, best practices, doing the best job, fussing and controlling everything we possibly can, doing this when we have to. Later, we will add the tools of statistical control Right now, we're just trying to run the perfect study. And you're right. Whoa, that might not go every time. Especially with young scientists who have crap for budgets and crap for time. We did a study once where we looked at 100 people who basically redid their master's or their dissertation after they got into academics and had better resources. All the ones that found different results, almost everyone that found different results, found the right answer when they had more resources and got it wrong earlier because of something they couldn't control, just too small of a sample, or some other form of crap that was imposed on them. So, tremendous question, and it let me go on a little bit about how hard it's going to be to do this when you get started. Oh, yes. Oh, God, yes. Yes. We were testing an associative hypothesis that if there's a difference, it's going to be in one direction. And that's all I was really hoping for. When we started disarticulating what the confounds were, we were able to suggest some standards to departments about what they ought to require in their masters and their dissertations that they didn't used to. And we literally reduced this. One advantage of being old, you can run the same 20-year study twice. And we, in those programs that took our advice about how to increase the standards for the masters and the dissertation, the number of switches plummeted. And all it was run a damn meta-analysis, figure out what your effect size is, and run the right number of participants. Do the damn power analysis. Because as we'll talk about later, we have way more mistakes by misses than by false alarms. Yes, my study's confounded exactly what she said. Anybody else? You're doing great. I love this job. All right, IVs and DVs. We just use these words like they meant something magical. And we assume that magic follows them around whenever we use them. Do you know what an independent variable is supposed to be? Independent. There should be absolutely no reason why people have the independent variable value that they do. We randomly assigned them, we manipulated them, and that's the value they have, and it should be related to nothing. It should be independent of everything. How are we doing? That's what an independent variable is. So now we have random assignment, which gives us initial equivalence. We manipulate the independent variable, which gives us temporal precedence and starts us down the road of ongoing equivalence. And then we maintain ongoing equivalence during the task in the data collection. And when we're done, we show that there's a statistical relationship between the IV and the DV. In a situation where only two variables are operating, the IV and the DV. So if they're related and one came before the other, causality. And the dependent variable is dependent on only the IV. See how confounds booger that up? So when you're using the word IV, make sure that, or more properly, when somebody else uses the word IV, make sure you stop and say, no, wait a minute, what do you got here? Do you really mean it's an independent variable? It's not related to anything. It's not confounded. It is created by a manipulation after a random assignment. And it's related to nothing. Or do you just mean a grouping variable? Or not even quite that. It's just the variable that in your heart of hearts is the causal agent in the story you're telling. Was there a hand? Okay. Okay. If I don't have a true experiment, I don't have the front end of causal interpretability. I don't have random assignment. I don't have manipulation. And manipulation is really important because a bad manipulation produces its own confounds.